Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, who is usually in LA, but is in New York for the weekend, hanging out with us to see some people at New York Film Festival, which is still going on, believe it or not. Are you excited to catch the big finale?
I love New York. And it's if people say they love New York in spring, I like New York in fall. And I always associate the New York Film Festival with the crisp fall, nip in the air kind of energetic feeling, and I'm loving it. I'm gonna it's At Eternity's Gate, the Julian Schnabel, which you and I both admire a great deal, and the closing night party, and we're gonna have a little IndieWire dinner, which I'm excited by, and I'm gonna interview Willem Dafoe, which I love Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, I mean, that movie is very well chosen for New York because Schnabel is like this, you know, kind
texture.
Of monolithic New Yorker, and it's a highbrow.
When are you talking to him?
We'll be chatting at some point or another. That guy moves at the speed of light. He's apparently just rolling into New York from some new exhibit he has in the UK. So, you know, it's one of those people who's just, you have to kind of grab him in the crowd in a way. But I think it'll play pretty well in New York. It's probably the best possible platform you could ask for a movie like this because it isn't necessarily an easy sell to a wide audience, but
it's definitely an art film, and it's a film about art. It's
but it's still got Defoe, it's got Oscar Isaac, there's some recognizable faces, and it does have an emotional resonance. It's not cold experimental. It invites you in to some degree because it really is about Van Gogh's headspace, and it represents that very well.
Definitely. What I've been noticing, and maybe you have too, there are a lot of films that are taking on the point of view of the protagonist and using the camera in inventive ways to get close, you know, to really mirror the point of view and get you immersed. And if you think about some of the things that go on in Roma or some of the things that go on in First Man, which is opening today, you know, Bryan Singer takes you much closer to the action. It's not the same kind of old-fashioned filmmaking that Ron Howard deployed on something like Apollo 13. It's much more teeth rattling and sort of close in on the cockpit, a little bit more like what Christopher Nolan did in Dunkirk.
Similar MO. And the thing is about something like First Man is that, you know, it has to deliver on the moon landing because that's what everybody's there for.
Well, that's when it goes big. Yeah.
Yeah, but what's sort of unexpected about the movie is that it's also, for the most part, a much quieter, kind of an intimate, soul-searching movie, which I think is to its credit from a storytelling standpoint. I don't know if it's always successful in terms of the way that it does that. In fact, I don't know if it totally is. It often felt a little bit like it was trying too hard to get you invested in the intimacy of the story, and there's a...
I saw it a second time, and I have to say that the first half, when you're really spending a lot of time in Houston with these sort of improvisatory, folks at home playing with the kids, you know, having barbecues with their friends, some of that went on a little bit long. But as soon as you get up on the Gemini flight and from there on right to the moon, I would say the movie kicks into gear.
Yeah, I mean, the technical side of this movie is really, really satisfying, but it's also kind of a hard sell in a way that I think people might not have anticipated, because the moon landing is almost too famous. I think what they've done in terms of representing the landing from a perspective you haven't seen before is remarkable. And
and they shot it in IMAX. They recreated the surface of the moon.
Yeah, they didn't use it's practical effects, you know. So that's what's really impressive about it. But I also wonder, it's like we have been inundated with the iconography of the moon landing for 50 years. And to some degree, I almost feel like a lot of people know that story so well that they're not necessarily compelled to go watch a movie about it.
That's an interesting thing, because one of the things the movie reminds you of is how many people watched the landing, you know, assuming you were old enough, you know, to be up and about. and all over the world. And it's one of those things where you remember where you were when you saw it. But the technology then was so gritty and video and black and whitish and awful looking. I mean, there were some great pictures taken too. This is on another level. This is stunningly, gorgeously clear and crisp. And I think the way that Chazelle tried to show you different angles on what it was like, you know, this very slow descent, you know, onto the surface and the looking at the footprint on the dust that's settling. I loved it. I loved what he did with that.
And the thing is, it doesn't even really depend that much on Gosling and all of that stuff. He's there and his voice is there, but you're really, it's pure filmmaking in the sense you're just watching a guy kind of in this suit. And really what the achievement is the way in which camera work and what they're doing visually beat by beat is sort of giving you a sense of what it's actually like to stand on this vacant, you know, dead world millions of miles from Earth and sort of contemplate things that you can't put into words without forcing that. I would have watched a whole movie of that when you think about it. So they were on the moon for a couple hours. I'd love to see a movie that's just on the moon. I think the challenge with First Man is that it's really hard to feel as invested in the more sentimental side of these things as much as, you know, Armstrong's backstory, what he went through with his very young daughter dying, but prior to all this stuff and then all the media attention, it's just not as compelling a narrative. I don't think the hook is as strong as the what the actual moon landing itself kind of represents.
I think what he's trying to do, Chazelle, is to somehow show you this extraordinary routine of like going into outer space and then coming home to the wife and kids. You know, it's like these were ordinary people doing extraordinary things and what it takes to achieve that. And I think those are valid questions. Whether it works dramatically, I think Gosling does an amazing job with a very high degree of difficulty.
I'm not totally sold on that, on his performance in this movie, to be honest with you.
Well, there's debate. There is debate about it. There's debate about how emotionally involving the movie actually is. I think I always lean on the side of how difficult was it, you know, to make this movie, and I think it was very difficult.
There's tremendous talent involved, no question about it, and I think that from the cinematographer to the music to Chazelle kind of behind all of the stuff, these people are absolutely some of the most talented young filmmaking teams making movies for mass audiences right now. It doesn't necessarily mean
that's a question. Are they making money movies for mass audiences?
Well, La La Land.
La La Land ended up transcending its art house origins and becoming an enormous Oscar contender and all of the above, everything we know. First Man is a major studio movie with a major studio budget. And the question is it going to click with a mainstream audience? The Right Stuff years ago did not. Apollo 13 did. I'm curious to see. I mean, it's projected to open at about $20 million this weekend, which is respectable, but not great. It'll come in around fourth, probably.
Probably not what you want, a movie that could be a serious awards contender, or at least with being positioned that way, as you know, launching out of Venice and then Telluride and so on and so forth. It makes you wonder exactly how much this movie is going to be a part of that conversation in the weeks ahead.
It's in the conversation. It's one of the best movies. Eric, as far as your colleagues are concerned, on Metacritic, I think it's at 84, something critics like that.
Critics have been kind
which
to
is,
it, but it's also
good.
Think about the Critics Awards that are coming up in the weeks ahead. And are they going to find room for this in a year of Roma and The Favorite or First Reformed or all these kinds of things? If you were going to go for, say, three random critics, if you were to take them out of a crowd and pull them on this movie, probably one of them would be a big fan and one of them would think it's okay and the other one would not be crazy about it. So let's talk about another movie opening this week, which we got a chance to dig into a bit out of Toronto, but now that it's here, I think we can kind of finally reach some consensus around Beautiful Boy, a movie that, you know, it's a respectable movie about an important issue that is not totally satisfying in terms of its complete picture. It's obviously, Timothée Chalamet, as this drug addict, delivers what he can from the material, and Carell playing his father is effective to the extent that he can be. I think the challenge with Beautiful Boy is that it is just so literal minded in terms of what it's portraying. And
Beautiful Boy, I think, is a little bit like Joel Edgerton's Boy Erased, in the sense that the filmmakers and the screenwriters are so closely embedded with the subjects of these stories. These are based on true stories, memoirs, that they lost the shape of the narrative that would engage the audience. And Timothée Chalamet is amazing. He'll get nominated, but there's something wrong with the movie. It's not doing that well with the reviews. If you look it up, it's like 69 or something on Metacritic.
That's really bad. I mean, people may not realize just how bad, you know, from a box office standpoint, that's doesn't look great for a movie like this. Of course, it's sort of baffling that the movie was made in the first place. I know Plan B, which has done some great work, really threw their weight behind it. And it seems like there's some serious kind of, you know, intentions behind this movie, because it's about recovery from addiction and all that kind of stuff. But it, the thing that I sort of struggled with when I was watching is that it kind of just, it plays like its description and not a whole lot more. And it was just sort of, I was hoping for something else, something to surprise me about this narrative, for the movie to explain itself beyond everything you know going into it.
But I think what happened, I mean, I think Plan B, they make exquisite movies. They're often Oscar contenders. They were behind Moonlight, If Beale Street Could Talk coming up, Selma, and the Adam McKay movie, The Big Short. They're really good. And what they did here, I think, was to think, in order to distinguish this from other movies on this subject and not have it be some kind of glossy drama, is they went for specificity. They went for the honest, authentic, true, story. And even there, even though it's admirable, you know, and elegantly made, it still feels like something's missing.
Right. And it's a little unfortunate too, because Felix Van Groningen, who made Broken Circle Breakdown, is a really great filmmaker and seems like a good match for this material that is, could become overly sentimental if it doesn't earn it. It does earn it. It's just, you want something a little bit more from all that. But I suppose Chalamet coasting along on the enthusiasm for Call Me By Your Name, and now sort of this, you know, global star is sort of he will survive this movie, because it's not a disaster, is it?
No, he comes out of it very well. I mean, you know, for example, Maura Tierney, who's really good in The Affair, is playing, you know, the women are given short shrift in this movie. Amy Ryan is playing his mother. She's playing his stepmother. There's this great scene where she's in a car and she's freaking out, and you go, yeah, hey, yeah, that's what we want from Maura Tierney, and she's just wasted through the movie. And something is very muted about Steve Carell. There's something, I don't know where it went wrong. I don't know if it was the directing or the screenwriting, or something happened where they just didn't find the right shape.
So the other movie that's coming out this week that's dealing with really tough material is getting a much more robust release, and that's 22 July, because this is Paul Greengrass's movie going to Netflix about the mass shooting in Norway. And what's really fascinating about it is this is unquestionably, I would say, his best piece of filmmaking since United 93, but actually not as hard to watch, because yes, it has this awful mass shooting, but it's front loaded with that. And then it goes off in this other direction, dealing with the aftermath and the shooter and kind of his attempts to bring the alt-right into this mainstream context. And so it's a very different kind of a movie. It sells you on its approach as it moves along. I think it's a little too busy and a little too long and a little too overwritten, but it's a very interesting approach to this subject matter that I wasn't totally prepared for. So I think this will be an interesting one to see how it does, given that Netflix is making it available all over the world in a way that, even if it's getting a small theatrical release, no studio would ever have done. So that's true.
And it's actually getting a theatrical release in some of those countries as well. I love this movie. I agree with you that it's one of his best. And it starts off in this very horrendous way, but it ends up being very uplifting, in the sense that this is how the country, Norway, dealt with this issue of the alt-right and this horrific act of violence. They put the man on trial. They allowed him to talk. They gave him a voice, and then they argued with him. And that is what is so moving about the film. It has a tough impact, but it gives us a kind of a way out of some of the horrible things that are going on, not just in America, not just in Norway, but all over the world.
Well, it's kind of similar to the conversation that's been going on with this documentary that Errol Morris did on Steve Bannon, when people are like, why would you create a platform for this guy? And the answer is sort of like, well, you could ignore it, but if you ignore it, then, you know, you're just allowing it to continue and do its thing. And in this case, I think we're seeing something similar, where it's sort of like, you know, there was this other film, Utoya, that premiered in the Berlin Film Festival about the shooting that didn't show the guy really at all. And this one is an attempt to kind of show how stupid and sort of corrupt his ideas were, and how by confronting him in this courtroom context, he was invalidated in his attempts to kind of take his ideas mainstream.
Yeah, so that it worked really well. Yeah, I love this movie. You and others have asked if this movie has an Oscar shot, and I do think that there's a difficulty with the smaller Netflix movies. They're giving a huge push to Roma, which has been established at a lot of the film festivals, but this is a smaller movie, and I don't know that even if they put it out in 28 theaters stateside, they won't be reporting numbers. It's not going to be a big hit or anything like that. No one will know. No one will ever know how well this movie does, how many people see it or anything. And that's part of the strange bubble that exists with Netflix that they're trying to break out of, and they're trying to somehow create buzz and interest in their titles. They have a lot of awards people and a lot of PR people working on their films now, and there are a lot more advertising around them. But there is something that theaters and numbers and real tracking and real word of mouth create that Netflix is starting to try to get hold of. But as long as they don't enter that system entirely, I'm not sure they'll be successful.
Well, one thing people aren't really talking about is how much more room for experimentation for different kinds of movies Netflix has, right? Because if you look at something like 22 July, you could actually connect the dots between how this movie's kind of activist message about confronting evil is similar to the kind of activist documentaries that Netflix gets behind, and that it's creating a platform for a movie that has strong ideas that could be good for the world. And if it was just an Oscar movie being released in the fall with the traditional platform release, that conversation might get folded into the awards conversation, but have less of a kind of global resonance. Whereas here, it's like, you know, some people like movies, some people don't like the movie, but more people are going to engage with it internationally. And so perhaps that metric for success is in some ways more valuable for the lasting impact of the movie than winning an Oscar. Whereas in the case of Roma, you want to get an Oscar. It's a movie that you would think should be a part of the Oscar conversation. So.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I support all of the things that Netflix do. Believe me, I'm an enormous supporter, and I love the fact that they got this movie made and it will be seen everywhere. I think it's the Oscar conversation where the disconnect occurs, and it's so fascinating to me that they're still so hell-bent on spending all that money and trying to emulate what the theatrical experience gives you. Yeah. That's my point. It's just ironic thing, I think.
And it's not really possible. You cannot replicate the theatrical experience at home. They're just two different categories of experiences. I mean, I love my TV. It's just never
going to be. It's not the experience I'm talking about. It's the community. It's the buzz. Resonance of having something in the conversation that you and I keep talking about. That's what they're trying to emulate.
But on some level, narrowcasting, I don't know if emulation is the right way to even think about it, because narrowcasting is something that's totally new in terms of how you get things to people, like that somebody in Morocco or whatever could be watching 22 July this weekend the same way that we are over here, as opposed to, you know, fingers crossed it shows up in their territory at some point. Like that, it's having an impact, perhaps, in a way that we can't totally understand. And that's something that really changes how we talk about theatrical being this sort of unique impact. Because
that's right. Because there's some way of measuring it, I guess. I think that's the thing that throws people off about Netflix, because it feels like this enormous void, you know, but it isn't. It's an enormous amount of content going out across all these different platforms all over the world, one platform really. And yet it's immeasurable. That's the thing. You can't see it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it, and you can't measure it.
So moving on from Netflix, the other company news worth talking about this week is a little more surprising, and that's whatever the hell is going on in Annapurna. As you put it so well in the headline for your piece, what the hell is Megan Ellison doing? Here's a company that has made some really solid movies this year, Sisters, Brothers. They released Sorry to Bother You, which did pretty well, close to $18 million, something like that. And yet it seems like a lot of stuff's not going well. In one day, we heard about two projects that fell apart. The president of production, Chelsea Barnard, who'd been there since the beginning, left, was fired, quit. Something happened there. And it seems sort of like this whimsical person at the top is kind of doing things her own way. And it, unfortunately, this may not be good for some quality movies that she's sort of shepherded along.
Well, it's one thing to be a billionaire scion producer with an exquisite taste, clearly. I mean, she made all of these movies with Paul Thomas Anderson, like The Master, and more recently Phantom Thread, which was released by Focus Features and did really well, 6 Oscar nominations. So her, you know, with Spike Jones, Foxcatcher with Bennett Miller, I mean, she's, the list just goes on and on. And, you know, of course, all the Kathryn Bigelow movies like Zero Dark Thirty, but Detroit was the first one to be distributed by Annapurna. And so what happened is that a lot of these people, like Crash, like Bob Yari, these people get into the movie business. They see a lot of the money that they think should be coming back to them, that they spent so much money to make these movies and energy and effort. And then it feels like the distributor gets to keep all the money. Well, it isn't like that. It's a shared thing. And a lot of time, not that much comes back. And that's, again, unfortunately, now that she thinks that she can be a distributor and hire smart people and make these movies work better than someone like Harvey Weinstein could or whoever she tangled with, now she's waiting for that money to come back, and it's not coming back in the way that she would like.
Yeah, this is sort of a different category.
Her father, by the way. It's her father who's getting impatient with spending all this money.
This is what people are saying. I mean, you always want to avoid trying to characterize things like this. I mean, this is a grown-up woman making her own choices, but clearly there are other elements in play here that kind of make it difficult to not see it in the terms you just described it as. I think there is still
reportedly,
but it seems likely that you know that's what the source of the money is, her father's wealth, so that there something must be tied up in all that. It's obviously a different category of problem than, say, Broad Green, where you had people who were running a company that also seemed so disconnected from the film world, period. I mean, as far as I can tell, you know, Megan is
she's not naive. But I think she's used to having her own way and not worrying about how much money these movies made. And now she has to worry about it.
And no matter what, there's too much at stake. You can't make a $40 million movie or a was it Vice?
Is $60 million. And that's the Adam McKay movie, the follow-up to The Big Short with Dick Cheney, played by an bulked-up Christian Bale. I want to see the movie. I am eager to see the movie. But anybody with a head on their head, on their shoulders, can see that $60 million is a lot for that movie. Yeah. And it means they have to make a lot, $200 million or so, to get their money back. Remember, 50% of what is reported as grosses goes back to the distributor. The theaters keep half of it.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, I think this story is going to keep developing, and more details are going to dribble out. Some of them more reliable than others. Obviously, the Annapurna spokespeople are just denying everything and saying it's just business as usual, but we'll see how it actually affects these movies in the weeks ahead. And I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to take a closer look at Vice and how that plays out once we get a chance to see it. So we don't even know if it's a good movie or not. So
no, but they lost their president back in April, June, that they lost, June. They lost their CFO. They lost their COO. They have lost lots of people over the past year, key people. So this isn't just an odd thing. The question is whether the messages that she's sending to the community are that there's something really wrong.
Right. So I guess it's set to be continued on this one. In the meantime, we've got the last weekend of New York Film Festival to hang out for a little bit and see how all that goes. And then next week, I'm sure we'll get a chance to evaluate further how things are doing, because there's a lot more that's still coming out. But we've got a lot of movies already, you know, from First Man to Star Is Born that are playing and generating new reactions. So that story will keep evolving. And yes, the Fall Festival will continue, the Fall Festival circuit.
The next one is AFI Fest, including the Steven Soderbergh, Sandra Bullock movie. Do you know anything about that?
No, basically nothing except what you just said. So there's that's a good start, though. It kind of, you know,
gets going.
That's enough to make me want to see it, obviously. And then you've got On the Basis of Sex and all that stuff. So much more to come. In the meantime, let's do our New York Film Festival scene.
See you later.
Bye.